Welcome to Audio Notes. I'm David Finkel, Artistic Director of Music at Menlo, and it is with great pride and eager anticipation that I extend this first welcome to the 2012 festival season, Music at Menlo's 10th anniversary. This season, we explore the power of music from the listener's perspective. How does music affect us? How do we use it? What does it mean to us? Over the course of 8 concert programs surveying music's various powers, from the animation of dance and drama to the deepest nourishment of the soul, this season meditates on the simple and audacious question, what is music for? We've entitled the season Resonance to reflect the deep fundamental exploration of music that we look forward to taking with you this summer. Just as the sound of music depends on the resonance of physical objects, our experience of it as listeners is defined by the emotional resonance it inspires. Music resonates not only in our ears, but in our hearts and minds, and affects us in ways that are impossible to capture in words. It is this strange and marvelous dimension of music that we celebrate this season at Music at Menlo. As in previous seasons, this year's installment of Audio Notes brings you in-depth discussions of the music you'll be hearing at the festival. I'll be joined by Artistic Co-Director Wu Han, Music at Menlo's Artistic Administrator Patrick Castillo, and a few of this season's festival artists who will take you deep inside the music and prepare you for the rewarding musical experience that our audiences have come to expect over the last 10 years. Thank you for listening, and we look forward to seeing you at the concerts.
Music nourishes the mind, sustains the soul, and gives voice to our most deeply felt passions. Music of great warmth and lyricism offers comfort, just as in works of majesty and brilliance we find inspiration and strength. This summer's first concert program, Sustained, illustrates the power of music to satisfy a most fundamental human need. The program begins with Franz Schubert's magnificent C major fantasy for violin and piano. In this work, and in the transcendent strains of Mozart's clarinet quintet, we encounter music's ineffable power to nurture our whole being. The program concludes with Beethoven's Indomitable Piano Trio, Opus 70, No. 2, one of the grandest assets of the composer's heroic period.
Franz Schubert, one of Western music history's greatest geniuses, was born in Vienna in 1797, the only composer of the Viennese canon native to that musical capital. His was a Vienna revolutionized by Beethoven's powerful symphonies, but likewise under the spell of Rossini's delectable operas and the thrilling virtuosity of Niccolo Paganini. In this environment, and supported by a devoted coterie of friends and patrons, Schubert quietly produced an astounding body of work. The American composer John Harbison has credited Schubert with writing, quote, the best piece in every genre he really tackled, end quote. Schubert's musical life was as ephemeral as it was remarkable. He took gravely ill in 1823, contracting what almost certainly was syphilis, and died 5 years later at the age of 31. But despite his great physical suffering and psychic anguish at the end of his life, Schubert remained incredibly prolific. Indeed, for the composer who had once proclaimed, I have come into this world for no other purpose but to compose, music truly represented an essential source of spiritual sustenance. In the final year of his life, Schubert completed the 2 piano trios, the 9th symphony, appropriately known as the Great, the cello quintet, and the last 3 piano sonatas, among numerous other keyboard, vocal, and orchestral works. All told, an imposing set of masterpieces, miraculously concentrated within a deeply trying 12 months, and unequaled by many composers over entire lifetimes. The C major fantasy for violin and piano dates from this exceptional final chapter of Schubert's life. The work begins with a hushed tremolando figure in the piano, from which emerges a long, generous melody in the violin. The violin hangs suspended above the trills and turns of the piano accompaniment, its infinite slowness seemingly belonging to another world. The second movement allegretto takes a more piquant turn, characterized by a mischievous repartee between the violin and piano. The centerpiece of the fantasy is the third movement Andantino, a set of variations on Schubert's lied, Sei mir gegrüßt. The particular character of the fantasy's Andantino movement derives from its seeming melodic innocence combined with the poignancy of Schubert's harmonies. Four variations on this vintage Schubertian theme follow, each one illustrating Schubert's melodic inventiveness. Following the gentle fourth variation. The music makes a striking return to the hushed awe of the fantasy's opening. The tension builds to a triumphant new melody, which brings the fantasy to a bright and optimistic conclusion. The music of Wolfgang Amadeus Mozart represents the pinnacle of the Viennese classical period. Mozart crystallized the innovations introduced by Joseph Haydn, the composer acknowledged as the father of the classical style, and such mature works as Mozart's clarinet quintet in A major demonstrate the characteristics of Mozart's music that have placed him in the highest stratum of history's great composers. The work's melodic beauty, sheer sonic richness, and overall transcendent quality are quintessential Mozart, and rank the quintet among the most inspired works in the chamber music literature. Mozart composed the quintet in 1789 for the clarinetist Anton Stadler. Stadler served as principal clarinetist for the court orchestra during Mozart's years in Vienna, and his technical virtuosity and widely heralded mellifluous tone have profoundly benefited music lovers, and in particular clarinetists, as they inspired both the clarinet quintet and Mozart's clarinet concerto, completed just 2 months before the composer's death. Clarinetist Anthony McGill.
Supposedly he was a genius at the clarinet. There were critics that mentioned that they've never heard anything come closer to the sound of the human voice than this clarinetist.
An element of Mozart's genius, demonstrated throughout his oeuvre, and especially in such a work as the clarinet quintet, is his instinctive understanding of the inherent character of the instrument he's writing for.
The first thing that comes to mind when I think about how he uses the clarinet in the clarinet quintet is that it's very lyrical throughout, even in the articulated passages, which there aren't that many of. It's still lyrical and legato. And I think this is what makes this piece, I think, so absolutely gorgeous throughout, is that it's so smooth and mellifluous. Just the way it starts off, the beginning of the piece with the first arpeggiated run, it's a legato run that starts from the very low of the instrument, goes up higher, and then kind of comes back down. And you see this fluidity that happens immediately.
The violin introduces the tender second theme, which the clarinet immediately echoes in the more melancholy key of E minor, over a soft syncopated accompaniment in the strings. The violin and clarinet engage in an amiable dialogue to close the exposition. After presenting the wealth of musical ideas that comprise the exposition, Mozart fashions a development section that can be described as nothing short of divine inspiration. Each of the exposition's themes reappears, but is now exploited to a completely fresh emotive effect, as individual lines combine to create a rich contrapuntal texture. Listen too for how Mozart uses the full range of the clarinet to color the string quartet timbre while the rest of the ensemble, seemingly unaware of the soloist's activities, pursue an increasingly heated conversation. The clarinet quintet closed Music at Menlo's 2006 season, at which time I was able to capture the late Michael Steinberg's supremely eloquent thoughts on this masterpiece of the literature.
And there is, of course, the amazing, deeply moving gift of simplicity that he shares with Haydn and that you find in some Beethoven and that seems to almost disappear from music after that. But you listen to the first phrase of the slow movement of the clarinet quintet, and there's nothing there. It's so obvious, you know, you wonder why you didn't think of that tune yourself, you know. But those marvels are very, very special, and I think no one commands that corner of music quite like Mozart.
The third movement is a minuet, a stately French dance in triple meter.
In the minuet, it's not a forceful dance, but it's a little bit rustic in character at times. It's a very spirited, extremely happy minuet, where it's just like there's no care in the world.
The final movement of the clarinet quintet is a theme and variations. Mozart's theme begins with a cheerful gesture in the violins, answered by the full ensemble.
The fun of this piece happens in the last movement, the variations. Everyone gets an opportunity to show off the qualities of the instrument. The clarinet has some great leaps, and at the time it was like an amazing feat to have these leaps from very low notes to much higher notes. And so you have these bum, bum, beam, these jumps like this that show off the virtuosity of the player and the instrument. And one of the great moments in the piece is the kind of chromatic, sorrowful viola solo. As soon as you've gone through that moment, you're into this faster kind of 16th note clarinet and violin display of technique. Soon after that, you're all of a sudden in this sublime area that basically reminds you of the Larghetto, where the violin has the solo and then the clarinet comes in after and connects beautifully into his own solo line to augment that. Of course, he always knows how to finish a piece. So you're in this beautiful moment, and there's a fermata, and the clarinet has a slight cadenza or not. And we're back into the melody of the very beginning again. And we end up with the allegro at the very end.
Following Haydn, with whom he studied, and Mozart, whom he idolized, Ludwig van Beethoven emerged as the most important voice of the Viennese classical tradition. He remained the most influential musical figure throughout the 19th century, haunting generations of composers long after his death in 1827. And he ranks today as arguably the most widely beloved composer in music history. His music comes out of the tradition he inherited from Haydn and Mozart, but contains a dramatic intensity and depth of personal expression that pointed the way to Romanticism and continues to resonate deeply with listeners today. Beethoven's music, for better or worse, is typically classified into three creative periods. This is a flawed and oversimplified view of his artistic life, of course, but it does help provide a basic framework in which to understand Beethoven's music. There are the early pieces that he composed prior to and during his first few years in Vienna, which most clearly bear the classical imprint of Haydn and Mozart. And then there's Beethoven's middle period, which pushed the boundaries of the classical tradition. In 1803, Beethoven said to a friend, quote, "I am not satisfied with what I have composed up to now. From now on, I intend to embark on a new path," end quote. This next chapter in Beethoven's artistic journey, which history has dubbed his heroic period, produced music of unprecedented magnitude. Also, it was during this time that his worsening deafness became a personal crisis. Beethoven responded with works like the iconic Fifth Symphony that were epic and defiant. In his final years, Beethoven again pursued a new direction. The music composed in the last decade of his life was extraordinarily ambitious in scope, in terms mystifying and transcendent. The piano sonatas, string quartets, and other works from Beethoven's late period reached new heights and continue to challenge, fascinate, and inspire listeners 2 centuries later. About one of Beethoven's final compositions, the Grosse Fuga, Igor Stravinsky said, quote, "It is an absolutely contemporary piece of music that will be contemporary forever," end quote. The 2 piano trios published as Beethoven's Opus 70 capture the spirit of the composer's heroic period. With these 2 trios, composed in 1808, Beethoven raised the technical and expressive standards of the piano trio genre to new heights. E.T.A. Hoffmann wrote of the Opus 70 trios, quote, "Beethoven carries the romantic spirit of music deep into his soul, and with what high geniality, with what deep sense of self-possession he enlivens each work," end quote. The E-flat piano trio, Opus 70 No. 2, is a radiant work. It's no less powerful a statement than such works as the Fifth Symphony, or its companion piece, the better-known Ghost Trio, Opus 70 No. 1. But the Opus 70 No. 2 trio transmutes the intensity of those works into a warm lyricism. Biographer Lewis Lockwood observes that, quote, "After the Ghost, the E-flat trio turns from the demonic to the human," end quote. Indeed, in contrast to the adrenalized opening of the Ghost Trio, the E-flat trio begins with a slow, introspective introduction. A more buoyant theme, marked by wide ascending leaps, announces the start of the main body of the movement. Yet even here, the fieriness of the Fifth Symphony yields to a more elegant temperament. Beethoven quickly recalls the music of the slow introduction. And transforms this music into an eloquent new musical idea. In the development section, the mood intensifies by vintage Beethovenian means. Thematic material from the exposition is fragmented, creating a feeling of anxiety, and the piano provides a restless accompaniment, arpeggiating a series of diminished seventh chords, one of the signature harmonies of romantic Sturm und Drang. The recapitulation restores the movement's sunny perspective, but as the music appears to approach a climactic point, Beethoven once again shows unexpected restraint. After this final remembrance of the slow introduction, the movement comes to a soft-spoken close. Beethoven foregoes a true slow movement, inserting instead a second movement's allegretto. The movement's opening melody is so sweet, so sincere, perhaps calling to mind some of Schubert's Lieder. But beneath the graceful demeanor of this first musical idea lies something more. As a pianist, Beethoven is known to have toyed somewhat with his listeners. He would lull them into a blissful reverie with soft lyrical music, and then suddenly play loud, crashing, dissonant chords. In his compositions, too, he would often work in such abrupt emotional extremes. Listen, after that quiet cadence we just heard, to the forceful gesture introduced by the piano. Beethoven continues to teeter between these two contrasting ideas, and he varies them along the way, keeping the listener unsure of what to expect. And perhaps, in a Jekyll and Hyde sort of way, a little uneasy, even during the music's most comforting moments. There's a nuanced psychological complexity to this E-flat piano trio that comes to the fore in places like those abrupt changes in character in the second movement, And even while he's fashioning those exquisite moments, Beethoven avoids the obvious expressive devices. Think, for instance, about the slow, thoughtful introduction to the first movement, where a more vigorous gesture might have been expected. And then, where a deeply sentimental slow movement might have gone, Beethoven writes instead an understated allegretto. Likewise, the trio lacks a true scherzo movement. In its place, Beethoven writes another allegretto. In fact, he marks the third movement allegretto ma non troppo, but not too fast. Exactly the opposite of what we would expect in a typical scherzo movement. Indeed, instead of a fast, frenzied scherzo, Beethoven gives us music of broad, sweeping lyricism. The finale is just as nuanced as the rest of the trio. As the movement begins, it appears that finally the listener's expectations will be met. We get these quick runs in the piano, punctuated by energetic ta-das in the violin and cello. But then the music immediately changes character. The piano shifts gears and plays a gentle, lyrical melody that gets picked up by the violin. Beethoven marks the passage piano and dolce, softly and sweetly. A more forceful second theme soon emerges. The exposition arrives at a resolute closing subject. As in the first movement, the development and recapitulation sections work over the thematic materials of the exposition, weaving a dramatically compelling conclusion to the Opus 70 No. 2 Piano Trio. All told, the E-flat Trio is a remarkably rich work. Reflecting a watershed moment in the creative life of one of history's greatest composers, it's a work that demonstrates masterful compositional technique and that offers a tremendous breadth of emotion, giving the listener always something new to discover. Audio Notes is authored and produced by Patrick Castillo and narrated by David Finkel, Wu Han, Patrick Castillo, and Isaac Thompson. Additional mastering is provided by Dahong Situ. Musical excerpts on this disc appear courtesy of the following artists and organizations. Schubert's C Major Fantasy is performed by Kaoru Yamada and Shoto Kinoch and appears courtesy of Stone Records, a member of Allegro Media Group. Mozart's Clarinet Quintet, performed by Anthony McGill, Georgia Flizanis, Jennifer Frauci, Carla Maria Rodriguez, and Colin Carr, and Beethoven's Piano Trio in E-flat, Opus 70 No. 2, performed by Derek Hahn, Ian Swenson, and Ronald Thomas, appear courtesy of Music at Menlo Live. Audio Notes is a copyrighted production of Artist Led.